want, so I can see. Good to see so many old friends and new victims. Wyatt Letcher, whose burden you're about to bear, owes its inspiration to John Wyatt, American ambassador to Britain during most of the Second World War, and a genuinely heroic figure in a really terrible time. The Wyatt Lecture then owes its realization to his son Rivington and to Rivington's wife Joan, and she continues to support British American initiatives through the Rothermere American Institute to this day. If I wonder what you will make of this particular incarnation, I wonder what they would make of it too. In any case, the popular complaint about current American politics is everywhere. Political parties are polarized, public opinion is volatile, policymaking is gridlocked. Journalists then add their usual bias to the contemporary complaint, claiming that what has just happened has never been seen before, and is, of course, the shape of politics for all time to come. But no one feels compelled even to try to tell you where the modern world came from, what causes it to hang around, and by extension, what might cause it to go. Enter the Rothermere American Institute and the Wyatt Lecture. At the RAI, someone might actually know something beyond the current moment, something that could be reformulated as context, both analytic and practical, for understanding that moment. And with the Wyatt Lecture, someone might be foolish enough to venture onto that territory. For such a venture, the story of how we got to the contemporary complaint, the inescapable organizing question has to be, what has been the relationship between party balance, partisan polarization, and policy conflict across American political history? You're going to hear those terms over and over in the next half hour. And if you want to start sort of chanting them in response whenever they come up, it's like an Al Gore rally. We can do that. And so at the end of it, you'll be every bit as successful as he. Party balance, partisan polarization, and policy conflict are related in one distinctive way at the current moment, but they have not always been related in this way. So there is hope that attention to the evolution of these three big moving pieces will pay intellectual dividends. For such an enterprise, we need a period of time, sufficiently long to allow these basic building blocks of political structure to interact in different ways, without being so long that social and organizational backgrounds to these influences are just no longer comparable. The obvious candidate, long enough to allow substantial change, not so long as to place us in an unrecognizable world, comes from the 80-plus years since the New Deal. I want you to see, I hope to convince you, that there have been four different political orders to American society during that period. Four different rearrangements among party balance, partisan polarization, and policy conflict. And that these are central to understanding how American politics worked during each of these four extended eras. A long period from 1932 to the present began with what is one of the biggest shifts in party balance in all of American history. And what became recognized as the High New Deal era, a substantial, reliable, and recurrent Republican majority that had been in place for 30-plus years, gave way to a huge Democratic majority instead, one that would be in place for 30-plus years after the shift, though it would require the New Deal program as a policy response in order to institutionalize this majority. So accordingly, we have to ask, how was the new party balance related to partisan polarization? Electoral politics was already incipiently polarized when measured by the difference between Franklin Roosevelt and Herbert Hoover in 1932, and looked more clearly so between Roosevelt and Alf Landon 4 years later. At the same time, legislative politics was minimally polarized. In effect, it was unipolar. The two elections of 1934 and 1936 were the only ones in American history when Northern Democrats were by themselves a majority of Congress. Yet the real operative polarization was neither between nor within the political parties, but rather between institutions, between a president attempting to lead a new partisan era, and a Supreme Court attempting to sustain an old one. We cannot know what would have happened to policy conflict if this institutional polarization had not been informally resolved. But it was resolved, so we are left knowing two big things about policymaking during this short introductory period. First, what ensued was a remarkably presidential policymaking process. Some residual policy initiatives did still arise in Congress and not at the White House, though more often even these were diverted and replaced by initiatives from the president and his staff. Yet bill after bill, and indeed major bill after major, came more or less directly out of the White House. Indeed, the 100 days, that lasting benchmark for policy productivity, was also simultaneously an implicit measure of presidential ability to get Congress to short circuit, and sometimes to avoid entirely the subcommittee and committee deliberations that have long been the essence of its role in policy making. Nevertheless, the second big thing that we know about policy making during the High New Deal era was that this was to be a remarkably short era. For the High New Deal, this particular mix of party balance, policy partners of polarization, and policy conflict was effectively over by late 1938. Which means it's very hard to separate the simple effect of economic disaster and then associated public demands for some policy response from the specific structure of politics that shaped this response for so short a time. The huge partisan imbalance of the High New Deal was clearly a result of universal public discontent with the Great Depression, rather than, certainly not, a response to a policy program that had, after all, not yet been enunciated when the shift began. Just as the operationally critical partisan polarization of the period between an ambitious president and a reluctant court was the result of a continuing institutional, indeed constitutional, structure where there really were massive differences in policy preferences and where the court most clearly did not follow the election in that familiar modern song. The policy process that resulted risked becoming extended gridlock on the grand scale as the court struck down major parts of the emergent New Deal. But victory by the president over the court allowed a truly presidential policymaking process to be confirmed. Yet this confirmed policy process itself ended in an impressively short time. The court began to surrender in April of 1937. The electorate terminated the High New Deal in November of 1938. On that calendar, who knows what we should say about it? Who knows how we can even separate and distinguish party balance, partisan polarization, and policy conflict in this consequential but short High New Deal era? None of that can be said, none of it even needs to be asked, of the late New Deal era, running from 1939 to 1968. That's easily long enough to come to grips with our three organizing concepts, one would think. On a question of party balance, Democratic hegemony in the voting public would remain for the entirety of this long successor era. The Democrats would lose Congress for only two terms during this entire period, while they would lose the presidency to only one man, Dwight Eisenhower. And now we had survey research, forelock of a tug, to confirm the substantial and ongoing Democratic imbalance in party loyalties. From 1952 onward, the American National Election Study would ask the general public, quote, generally speaking, do you think of yourself as a Republican, a Democrat, an independent, or what, unquote. And the resulting measure of party identification would vastly augment our understanding of mass politics, just as it would simultaneously sow huge interpretive mischief. Yet now, this time, and very much unlike the High New Deal era, the major party imbalance that characterized this genuinely lengthy period would become and remain impressively depolarized, not polarized, whether the focus was electoral, legislative, or institutional this time. Didn't matter. Moreover, the explanation for the change is clear and straightforward. In this successor late New Deal era, politics was reliably depolarized because it assumed a stable but multi-factional character. The simplest way to summarize this is to say that there was more or less a three-party system in the nation as a whole, featuring Northern Democrats, Southern Democrats, and regular Republicans, reinforced by a fourth faction, Northeastern Republicans, who were often also in play. Yet what made this background to the resulting policy process additionally complex, albeit still highly structured, was that the major issues of the day did not even align these four factions in the same way. Social welfare was still the biggest policy arena of the time, and it pitted liberal Northern Democrats against conservative regular Republicans in a struggle to hold or lose Southern Democrats, or perhaps substitute Northeastern Republicans. Foreign affairs became a major concern by way of the long Cold War, and it pitted internationalist Southern Democrats against isolationist regular Republicans in a struggle to hold or lose Northern Democrats and Northeastern Republicans. And civil rights, rising as a major policy concern across the entire period, pitted liberal Northern Democrats against conservative Southern Democrats, with both Republican factions, the regular Republicans and the Northeastern Republicans, in play between the two Democratic factions. There were three substantive areas then to characterize policy conflict in the late New Deal era, with three separate and distinct factional coalitions inside them. They came with the sure and stable knowledge that success for any one of these coalitions within any one of these policy domains required the temporary abrogation, albeit always temporary, of the other two. The resulting policy process, and a great social science discovery of the period, was incrementalism. An incremental policy process featuring constant negotiations over policy coalitions and producing more or less constant adjustment and readjustment of major public policies. That was what ensued. Go back and look at the world described by David Truman in The Governmental Process, or Richard Fennell in The Power of the Purse. Landmark social science of the period that is now distant political history. If you go back, you'll meet a world of procedurally intricate but effectively constant coalition building, both within and across the political parties. Indeed, Aaron Wildavsky, in The Politics of the Budgetary Process, could actually formalize the increments such that even the larger changes looked like nothing so much as the expected outliers in a regularized process. Which left everyone unprepared to interpret the successor era of divided government when it finally arrived and then settled in from 1968 to 1992. Too many political scientists had instead concentrated on complaining. You may have noticed that. During the long late New Deal era, some professions get traits and they don't go away, about the diagnostic incrementalism that characterized its policy process. It would be better, they said, if the parties were farther apart, if legislatures were less productive, but if the policies that did emerge could not be dismissed as increments. Ultimately, in our time, a just God would give them everything. But in the meantime, the late New Deal era really did expire to be replaced by an era of divided government. In this, Democratic strength actually increased in Congress. We somehow forget that. We repress that. We don't even know that. Yet Republicans captured the presidency in all but the Watergate-fueled Carter accident. And the public certainly corrected that accident at its first opportunity. So for us,
The first point about the new era is that party balance did not help much in interpreting what became split partisan control with stable electoral outcomes. Democrats always controlled Congress, Republicans always controlled the presidency, and surveys of party identification were thus utterly befuddling. With that one Carter exception, whichever party had the fewest adherents was always the winner in our lone national voting contest. People teach classes on party identification. They don't put it that way. What did help in interpreting the era of divided government was the changing nature of those political parties with which citizens identified, along with the changing substance of major policy issues with which partisan activists wished or needed to grapple. Throughout the late New Deal era, throughout the preceding era, there had been an old world of party politics, featuring a formal hierarchy of party offices manned by long-serving incumbents. David Mayhew, in Placing Parties in American Politics, captures this old world broadly and in rich detail, albeit at more or less the very moment that it was finally being demolished. What replaced it was a new world consisting essentially of social networks connecting issue activists. Our own Alan Ware broke that story open in The Breakdown of Democratic Party Organization. These newly consequential issue activists in turn propelled and were propelled by fresh issue alignments. And the first of these, the long-running Cold War consensus, broke down to become instead polarized by party among these increasingly issue-oriented party activists. And this was followed in very short order by a cluster of fresh, essentially cultural concerns. The environment, school prayer, women's roles, gun rights, abortion policy, family values, on and on. You could add as many as you like. Criminal justice, gay rights, educational policy, patriotism, the public role of religion, public deportment. What resulted structurally, was an ongoing elite mass tension within both parties. Democratic activists were now reliably liberal. They remained liberal on social welfare. That certainly did not change. And they added a strident liberalism on cultural values as well. Democratic mass identifiers, on the other hand, retained a huge body of supporters who likewise remained liberal on social welfare, but had never been liberal on cultural values. And they were not about to become so. Republican activists, in turn, were now reliably conservative. They remained conservative on social welfare, perhaps becoming even more so. And they added a strident conservatism on cultural values. By contrast, Republican mass identifiers retained a huge body of supporters who likewise remained conservative on social welfare, but had never been conservative on cultural values. And they too did not become so. Social change might have been sufficient by itself to cement these divisions into place during the era of divided government, but they are hugely facilitated by participatory institutional reforms aimed essentially at maximizing the power of issue activists. Best known among these was the root and branch restructuring of the process of presidential nomination, sidestepping the official party by way of Canada primaries in most states, and sidestepping it by way of open participatory caucuses, wherever the primary did not ultimately prevail. Yet this process reached comprehensively into Congress too, the form of an extended committee bill of rights, for example, just as it reached into much of the federal bureaucracy by way of a panoply of open government reforms. One other thing also happened, of course. It seemed entirely anomalous in its time. It seems obvious looking backward. Economic and social welfare matters stayed rooted in Congress. Attending to such matters on a districted basis was, after all, what congressmen and senators had always done. Foreign policy and cultural values found their way to the presidency instead, partly because they just seemed like more holistic concerns, partly just because presidential candidates shifted their issue focus more regularly and reliably. And divided government
split partisan control of the institutions of American national government became a logical and lasting outcome. Yet please note what did not happen to policy conflict during this lasting, indeed institutionalized, era of divided government. Because the Republicans always controlled the presidency, while Democrats always controlled Congress, for there even to be a resulting policy process, it required both cross-party and cross-institutional negotiations, and those negotiations did ensue. The parties had little real hope of ending divided government. Rather, it was now the basic background to this new policy process, to any new policy process. Indeed, the only thing that appeared able to generate public restiveness sufficient to break up this diagnostic split partisan control would have been a generalized public perception that one or the other of the two major parties was mainly responsible for the failure to act on major national concerns. And there were major social forces that appeared to demand action. These were rooted variously in burgeoning new social movements, as with the environmental groups that began to dot the landscape, or in persisting economic problems like the galloping and insistent stagflation that dogged the era. Thus, increasing environmental degradation was the consistent target of a burgeoning environmental movement, just as lengthening queues at the petrol pump kept stagflation at the front of the brain for major parts of the general public. What resulted then was thus not legislative gridlock, but comprehensive negotiations, often ratified in overwhelmingly bipartisan votes. Only this policymaking process can explain how the administration of Republican Richard Nixon could make the greatest 20th century contribution to environmentalism, or how the administration of Democrat Jimmy Carter could similarly inaugurate the late 20th century effort at comprehensive deregulation. Thanks for the nod there, Guy. This has been approved. The last sentence was correct. When all of this was in turn swept away in the modern era after 1992, perhaps best titled the era of partisan polarization, analysts were again and as ever unprepared. The National Election Study told them that party balance was still largely unchanged. Yet a stable, if split, pattern of Democratic Congresses and Republican presidencies was replaced by every possible combination of outcomes and in dizzying succession. Unified Democratic control under Bill Clinton in 1992 started the new era. Split partisan control under Clinton followed only 2 years later, but the wrong way around, with a Democratic president and a Republican Congress. Unified Republican control under George W. Bush succeeded Clinton in 2000. Split partisan control under Bush the old way returned in 2006 with a Republican president and a Democratic Congress. Unified Democratic control surfaced under Barack Obama only 2 years later in 2008. Split control under Obama the new way, Democratic president, Republican Congress, replaced that only 2 years further on. What could impel this apparently close but obviously kaleidoscopic set of results? The simplest answer was that the partisan polarization characterizing party activists during the era of divided government had captured everything in politics by the modern era, including most especially now those incumbent Congress people. But increasingly, even the mass media of information that covered them. Where had this dominating polarization come from? Two places, most especially. Both had been building during the era of divided government, but the major implications of both were to be harvested, to come home to roost, only during the modern era. First, the modern era institutionalized the percolating disappearance of the once solid South. That critical third party of the late New Deal era, the Southern Democrats, had been in transition during the era of divided government and effectively expired in the modern era. This long and consequential evolution is usually addressed in arguments over the impact of economic development versus racial desegregation. I have a dog of my own in that particular fight.
Yet here, within a framework of party balance, partisan polarization, policy conflict, the point is instead that when a major one-party region becomes aligned with a national two-party system, increased national partisan polarization is a major and inevitable result. Yet while this was happening regionally, albeit with national implications, the ideological reach of participatory politics was extending from party activists to party office holders. The national world of American party politics was thus itself remade in two major ways. Into the early 1990s, there were still notable clusters of Democratic congressmen and senators who were more conservative than a number of Republican counterparts. And the obverse of notable clusters of Republican congressmen and senators who were more liberal than a number of Democratic counterparts. During the 1990s, both ideologically moderate groups expired. In the late New Deal era, these were the individuals who had constituted the pivotal groups that made the policy process of the time function. In the modern era, they ceased to exist. Meanwhile, back in the States, active Democrats became more or less ideologically interchangeable from state to state, and active Republicans the same. In the old late New Deal era, there could be as much difference between Mississippi Democrats and Minnesota Democrats as between Minnesota Democrats and Minnesota Republicans, or between New York Republicans and Arizona Republicans compared to New York Republicans and New York Democrats. In the modern era, that was patently and more or less uniformly untrue. And the two developments, the death of centrist elected officials and the homogenization of party activists, were of course mutually and powerfully reinforcing. The two parties thus became more ideologically coherent internally while moving farther apart, not closer together as too many social science theories would predict. Yet at the same time, these polarizing parties actually managed to bring major issue realms, social welfare, foreign affairs, civil rights, cultural values, into alignment by party. In the late New Deal era, three major issue domains had generated three shift in factional coalitions. In the modern era, four major issue domains generate only one. Result was also a policy-making process where blocking the other side became a sensible goal, in the realistic belief that one more election might change the absolute balance in partisan control of government. This was a process so frequently derided in our time as gridlocked, but that was a remarkably loaded and unhelpful vocabulary. Instead, what needed to be said about this process was that it featured extended stretches of policy stasis, punctuated by occasional but reliably major spikes of legislative activity. Go back over the planned eruption of the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, or the unplanned but always impending eruption over the national debt and the default crisis, and you can see this sort of stasis and spike dynamic in action. Barbara Sinclair, Unorthodox Lawmaking, was an early recognition of the growing role of such omnibus legislation. In the late New Deal era, coalition building and rebuilding, most often in congressional subcommittees, have been the dominant policy process. In the era of divided government, cross-party and cross-institutional negotiations, superficially ratified by massive bipartisan majorities, have been the dominant policy process instead. And in the modern era, this was replaced by what became jointly partisan and institutional warfare, only intermittently but still often consequentially resolved by a deal between the White House and Capitol Hill, though commonly ratified still only by cliff-hanging ballots on the floor of Congress this time. These latter resolutions from this modern counterpart were the punctuations that in our time could produce omnibus legislation. Sometimes this was driven by consensual crises, sometimes by the expiration of major laws, but sometimes just by the buildup of policy pressures among major organized interests, each and all bundled together on the bus rulemaking. Same policymaking process that intermittently produced these bundles also helps explain why, for example, the Senate filibuster became such a central governing device in the modern era. It's a great device for the policymaking process that we've just described. Or why Presidents Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, and Barack Obama, in escalating order, began to assert their ostensible right to govern unilaterally. That's the way they like to deal with the policy process characterizing the modern era. So what do we say, heading toward a close, about the relationship between party balance, partisan polarization, and policy conflict? In the long and winding period from 1932 to the present, the six-year High New Deal continues to look so distinctive, at least to me, that making it fit into any mold seems fraught. While the three extended successive periods are sufficiently diverse as to constitute implicit cautions against generalization, each in their own right, one after the other, still, some things should be said. The frequent theoretical argument that close party balance produces depolarization by way of enforced party competition across a moderate middle seems absolutely untenable within this historical survey. If anything, the reverse is true. Party imbalance goes with partisan depolarization, while close party competition polarizes. Likewise, the old theoretical complaint that partisan depolarization poisons policy conflict by keeping issues off the agenda while blocking legislation on them when they happen to appear seems untenable as well. If anything, the reverse once again appears true. Partisan depolarization facilitates constant legislation by small steps in multiple domains, while partisan polarization favors occasional major omnibus resolutions within extended stretches of policy stasis. Two other points emerge, stroppier but at least more forward-looking. One involves not just popular but also scholarly complaints about politics in our time, or indeed in any time. In this, the character of the policy-making process at any given moment follows more or less ineluctably from the nature of the party balance and the level of partisan polarization that are in effect underpinning it. QED, stop complaining. If you do not like the policy banking process in your time, fix the nature of the underlying party balance and or its associated partisan polarization. If you cannot fix either, take a deep breath. Please note, this does not imply that the substance of major policy conflicts is either unimportant or easily manipulated. Very different policy realms have been at the forefront of political conflict during these four extended eras, and both the priority of these overall realms and the specifics of policy conflict within them have had a great deal to do with how the level of partisan polarization, or even with how the nature of party balance, actually worked. Second stroppy point, likewise involving both popular and scholarly complaints, involves the production of public policy as a response to ostensible public problems. Close party balance and exaggerated partisan polarization do appear to go with extended stretches of policy stasis, as punctuated by those intermittent but major spikes in policy making. What we cannot easily say is that this pattern produces worse, or even less, policy making in the long run than does the incremental alternative. Over 18 months, incrementalism probably does better. Over 18 years, the jury is truly out. What does seem clear is that there was never any point before the modern era when it made sense to ask the party balance and partisan polarization that underpinned an older policy process, the one characterized by incrementalism, to instead generate the modern process, characterized by policy gridlock punctuated by major initiatives. Just as there is no point in the modern era to asking the party balance and partisan polarization that underpin the current policy process, the one characterized this time by punctuated gridlock, to instead take us back to the world of classic incrementalism. This is a common academic and journalistic fantasy. It should go away. But this is, again, most definitely not to say that the substance of policy conflict is itself somehow dependent on the nature of party balance and or the level of partisan polarization. Rather, what the general public or partisan activists or both together judge to be worth fighting about is inextricably linked to the way that party balance and partisan polarization actually work. So in closing, truly, what can we say about the structure of American politics in our time? That is, what can we say now that we have chased it through the last 80 years and counting? In other words, if we are not allowed simply to complain, how should we reformulate popular complaints about modern American politics? I think the answer goes something like this. The balance between the two parties within the general public is closer than in the late New Deal era or the era of divided government. This is true even when party identification is the measure. It is much truer when voting behavior is the focus, though a democratic edge remains. The active political parties are just as clearly farther apart than in either the late New Deal era or the era of divided government. It would have been theoretically possible for the two to move closer together as they became more closely balanced. That is not what happened. What resulted instead is a kind of over-responsiveness by the party system to limited shifts in voter preference or even in voter turnout. This contributes a reliable partisan overshoot, in the process creating a greater potential for public disappointment with the most recent partisan change, whether it be Republican or Democratic. Moreover, there do remain major policy realms that still do not align neatly with the old social welfare basis of the party system or with the collective issue alignment that succeeded it. Such issues are thus one more continuing incentive to generate those limited voting shifts that have an augmented impact on partisan control of government and make a simultaneous contribution to public discontent. All of which leaves us in a peculiar but familiar position. For a social scientist, or perhaps for anybody. To wit, we have easily enough information and analysis to put the lie to some very familiar arguments about the structure of modern politics. Yet the same material within the same framework cannot be specified sufficiently that we can talk with confidence about where the critical factors within that politics, party balance, partisan polarization, policy conflict, more or less must go next. Is that because we have just not thought deeply enough or reached back far enough? Or is it because politics, and indeed social life, even when reduced to three key elements thereof, is just far more contingent than we ordinarily admit?